Hello, everyone. This is your Science at UH host, Dr. Dan Simon. Today, I am here with a special guest, Dr. Guilherme Attizzani, co-director of the Valve and Structural Heart Disease Center and the Alexander and Mariana McAfee Chair in Innovative Cardiac Interventions at University Hospitals Harrington Heart and Vascular Institute. Welcome, Dr. Attizzani.
Thank you so much, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
So, Guilherme, you know, your story of getting to Cleveland and UH is incredibly interesting, and your overall journey in cardiovascular medicine. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got to UH as a research fellow, and how you ended up doing structural heart disease intervention.
Yeah, Dan, this is an interesting story. I'm going to try to summarize it very briefly to you, but I did my interventional fellowship. I'm Brazilian, as you know, and did my interventional fellowship, finished 2007. And then I met Marco Costa on the hallway of a Congress, and I literally came to him and said, Dr. Costa, I don't know you. You don't know me. I know of you, and I would like to become somebody one day. So can I come to Cleveland to do research in intravascular imaging? This was back in 2009. And then I came, stayed here for 1 year. I was supposed to stay for 1 year, but I ended up staying for 2.5 years. And back then, it was when structural heart was becoming like a hot topic in interventional cardiology. And as you know, in Europe, the experience was larger because of the FDA regulations and approvals. So they approved all of those devices earlier in Europe. And then I ended up going there. I talked to Marco, to you back then. And then I ended up going to Catania, to Italy. Spent 2 years there and came back in 2014. So it was an excellent opportunity for me because I was exposed to different procedures that a lot of them were not even being done in the United States back then. And the volume in Europe back then was larger. So I came here with a lot of experience and 2014, everything started back at UH and I'm here for 11 years.
You know, it's an amazing story. And I think it's something that as an interventional cardiologist, that I had noticed just even in the coronary space. So as you know, regular stents were developed by Palmas and Shaw's and drug-eluting stents from Brazil with a variety of people who really drove that technology. And so it was very clear to us that if you wanted to be successful, you needed to go, as we said, OUS, outside the US. So that was one of the reasons why I recruited Dr. Costa, and your story is so reminiscent of Marco's when he told me that he sort of stalked Patrick Sarois at a meeting and convinced him to train with him. And then, you know, as you say, the rest is history and the same for you. So it's so incredibly inspiring to me to look at you and remember when you came here as a fellow in our imaging center and now lead all of our programs in this space that are in our international authority that we'll get to in just a moment. So for the audience, maybe you could explain to them, what does a structural heart disease center do? What kind of procedures and what kind of team is present in those procedures?
Yeah, that's very important. And it's a comprehensive team. There are multiple different healthcare professionals involved in structural heart interventions. And basically what we do, we repair and replace dysfunctional heart valves, as well as correct, for example, paravalvular leaks of surgical as well as transcatheter valves. We do PFO closures, ASDs, VSD closures. So there are multiple different types of procedures. Now, also, we do alcohol septal ablation for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So there are different types of procedures that we perform. And the importance of having a multidisciplinary team working together is because there are multiple options that are either transcatheter or surgical options, or sometimes even hybrid options that we can offer to these patients, right? So that's why it is important to have this multidisciplinary team working together. But not only surgeons and interventionalists are part of this. Of course, our nursing team, extremely important, as well as, for example, other areas of such as pulmonary hypertension for the tricuspid patients, heart failure physicians for the tricuspid as well as mitral regurgitation patients. We have also the EP team that we engage now for our tricuspid interventions with the complexity of transcatheter replacement and repair of tricuspid, understanding what to do with the pacemaker leads that are through the tricuspid valve that are going to have to replace. So it is really the definition of a multidisciplinary team that working together ultimately delivers the best to our patients.
So, you know, Jeremy, I think it's hard for people to imagine. And I know that if you had said to me back in 2010 and 11, when we traveled to Portugal to see and do our first TAVR cases, where, as you mentioned, the technology had advanced in Europe quite quickly, it was unimaginable to do a valve replacement in an awake and talking patient without no incisions and no cardiopulmonary bypass. Never in a million years would I have imagined in medical school that you could replace a valve in an awake and talking patient. Maybe you could walk the listener through what exactly is a TAVR? How's it done? Like in a quick description. And how did this develop? I know Dr. Cribier started this procedure from France, but maybe you could give a little bit of background on how this procedure has now become the majority of how we treat aortic stenosis.
Yeah, this is a fascinating story, Dan, because as you said, Alain Cribier developed the balloon expandable valve. And in an adjacent lab, another French physician, Jean-Claude Laborde, who partnered with an engineer, developed the self-expandable valve. So there are two different devices, and they developed those valves. And in 2002, the very first implant was done. And since 2002 to today, it was really an overwhelming growth of this procedure because the techniques have improved. Of course, the devices also became better. And the expansion of indications came from prohibitive surgical risk patients all the way to low surgical risk patients. In fact, TAVI today is performed more often than open heart surgery for aortic valve replacement. Most of these procedures are done via transfemoral. And as you said, we pioneered actually at UH back in 2013, 2014. We were doing already TAVI under local anesthesia with sedation, right? And back then we had the anesthesia team in the room. Today, it's a nursing-led sedation. It's a procedure that there is a cardiac surgeon, an interventional cardiologist, transfemoral, minimal sedation, local anesthesia. Patient gets the valve replaced, takes like 1 hour, roughly the procedure, 1 hour and a half. And most patients, 95% of our patients go home next day. Most patients do not go to an ICU. They just go to a regular telemetry bed. And when you look at the procedure from outside, it seems to be like a simple procedure because we perfected this procedure over time. And indeed, then, as you know, right, we have taught more than 800 healthcare providers from all over the world that they come to UH to learn from us. Folks from the US, from Latin America, from Asia, from everywhere, to learn from us how to perform this procedure in the most efficient way while the patient is awake and the whole pathway of the procedure, not only the actual procedure, but also what do we do in clinics, how do we handle the procedure in the leanest possible way while delivering excellent outcomes. And also, how do we handle the patient post-procedure? Where does the patient go to? What are the things that we have to look for? So we are very proud that UH became a reference, an international reference on optimal practices for TAVR. And in addition to that, another important aspect to this conversation is that we do live cases for the most important congresses in the world very frequently. Just 1 month ago, actually, I did two live cases for Sydney, Australia, another live case for India, 2 days in a row, one Thursday and one Friday. And we do a lot of live cases to showcase, again, the leadership of university hospitals in this procedure done that way.
Well, congratulations to you and your team. And I think I remember when we became a center of excellence for Medtronic and we started having hospitals come to the cath lab and they just couldn't believe, first of all, that we were doing the procedure in the cath lab and not in the operating room or the hybrid OR, and that the patients were all awake. And so you and Dr. Costa and many others played a critical role in changing the way that procedures were done in the United States. So the valve is a stent associated with bioprosthetic material, typically the pericardium of a pig or a cow. And these valves work really well, but like any bioprosthetic valve, they have a defined lifetime. And you've been very, very much involved now that we've had patients who've had these valves for more than a decade. Tell us a little bit about what is the longevity like? And then, of course, what leads to your role now as the national PI of the RESTORE study, for repeat TAVR. So when the valve runs out, what do we do? So give us a little bit about the longevity performance of the valve and what is Restore.
Yeah, that's very important. Then it is fascinating how when you see the whole story of a procedure, how the procedure evolves and how the challenges change, right? In the beginning, when we brought these patients or these procedures, we wanted to make sure that the patient was going to leave the room with no paravalvular leak, with no stroke, and with a good echo result. Today, the challenges are very different, right? We have the challenges now of, as you said, treating these valves when they fail. In terms of the durability, there's no data that indicates that these valves would last less than a surgical valve. So there have been studies now with like 10 years of follow-up. We published a meta-analysis 2 years ago looking at the durability of these devices. And when we talk to patients, the conversation goes as that the durability is potentially the same as a surgical valve, a biological surgical valve. And data is showing more and more. Once patients live longer, we have this data. As you know, then in the beginning, when we treated those very high risk and prohibitive surgical risk patients, obviously we wouldn't follow these patients for that long because they would die for other reasons and not because of the valve. But today we have good, robust data showing the good durability and good valve performance overall. Then to address the failed transcatheter valve with another transcatheter valve, we call it TAV-in-TAV, right? That's a very different procedure. It's a very complex procedure, not the procedure itself, but the planning for this procedure. And because of that, because nobody in the world has a large amount of experience with TAV-in-TAV, right? So we're doing this study in the United States and Canada called RESTORE, in which we're going to include around 400 patients. And it's hard to include 400 patients for TAV-in-TAV because this is not very common, thankfully, to see failed transcatheter valves as of yet, right? So we're doing this study to understand. It's a very comprehensive study in terms of the planning, the CT procedural planning. So you have an idea that very differently from surgical valves, these valves, when implanted, it's pretty much very similar to a coronary stent, right? The expansion of the valve not necessarily is going to happen as if you were implanting that in a rounded tube, right? So basically, that's going to depend on the interaction of calcium, et cetera, right? So when we do the planning for a TAV-in-TAV, we have to take all of these factors into account. We have to measure in different levels because in different levels of the failed valve, you may need to implant a different size valve. So you have to be precise in your measurement, in the landing zone. So it's a very, very complex procedure that I'm proud to be the PI, the national PI of this study that we're going to learn very much from. We have started already. We have treated 4 patients. We just started the study. And I'm very excited about it. It's really going to be a very important learning process for everyone in the world, the results of the RESTORE.
Well, I can't tell you how proud we are of you, Guilherme. I mean, to think that you came here as a bright-eyed and bushy-tailed fellow, and now you're a chair professor and the national PI of a trial is just, I mean, it just warms our hearts. And we're so lucky to have you and your team. Before we conclude, maybe you could just run us through a little bit of this early, I think last week, I got a beautiful picture from your group of a totally implanted valve in the tricuspid position. And obviously, you've now moved from the aortic valve to the mitral valve, and now we're in this tricuspid space. Tell us a little bit about the future and how you think you're going to be managing all these valves going forward.
Yeah, that's really fascinating, Dan. Before I go on that, I would like to really express my gratitude to you and how much you and others, Alan Markovitz and other friends, and now Maddie as the president of the Institute. So you all supported my career tremendously. So I'm very grateful to you. Really, truly appreciate you all. Then going back to the interventions, then it's really fascinating what we can do percutaneously today, right? So in the mitral space, we can do, as you know, mitral clips with very complex valves. But also there are two other clinical trials that we have that are replacing mitral valves. And they're two different valves that they actually complement each other. So it's fascinating how we can do percutaneously a full replacement of the mitral valve. Then in the tricuspid space, which is a very different space in terms of the imaging, in terms of the multidisciplinary team that is involved. And my colleague and coworker, Dr. Okigwe, Anene Okigwe, is leading our tricuspid intervention. So she and I are performing these procedures. And basically, there are three procedures that we can do. One of them is a tri-clip, which is similar to the mitral clip. So we put a clip in the tricuspid valve, and that's an FDA-approved procedure, as well as the full replacement with the Evoque valve, which is a full replacement of the tricuspid valve. It's a very intuitive procedure, very much imaging-driven, but it's a very beautiful procedure that you end up with zero TR in most of the patients. And we also have a clinical trial with a different valve with Medtronic, which is called the Intrepid valve. There, it's Apollo. It's the same valve that we use in mitral position, but using tricuspid. And we are about to start another trial with a different device in tricuspid. So there are multiple different devices. And I think due to our leadership on the field, we have all of these different devices to offer to our patients and basically able to treat most of the patients that need either mitral or tricuspid intervention. And I would like to also add then to the fact that our left atrial appendage group, we just did our 1,000 left atrial appendage closure. And we do all of these cases under local anesthesia, also in ICE guided. So these patients are ICE, meaning intracardiac echo guided. So these patients are awake, and I'm very proud of our team led by Steve Philby, the LAO closure. So I'm very proud that we have been leaders in the United States on how to do left atrial appendage closure with the awake patient, similar fashion that we used to do TAVIs, or that we do TAVIs, I should say.
Well, you know, Guilherme, it's just amazing to think that these technologies have developed, allowing us to treat patients who are older, right? So these tend to be much older patients, and they dramatically improve quality of life and duration of life, especially in severe aortic stenosis. And yet they save lives, and they also save healthcare expense, which is amazing. So it really hits our goal, which is to treat patients with greater value, better outcomes, even at a lower cost. It's so great to be with you. I learned so much from you, and I'm so proud of you. So thank you all for listening today. To learn more about research at University Hospitals, please visit uhhospitals.org/research. Thank you, Guilherme.
Thank you very much, Dan, for the opportunity.